This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Twitter thread, bookcase credibility, in which Zoom callers are analysed based on their bookcase background. I have heinous bookcase credibility at the moment because I'm in a child's bedroom. So
there are a lot. That's your bedroom. That's not a child's bedroom.
That's a child's bedroom. Come on. But I think you've got decent bookcase credibility from what I can see, Andy.
Are your books locked away, Andy? They look like they're in a glass case or something. Is that? Special.
That would be, oh dear.
No, they're not in a glass case, but you are perceptive because those shelves came with doors, but I just didn't use the doors.
Right.
So the shelving units.
That's an aesthetic choice you made.
I didn't ask you here to judge me, Lawani, but thanks.
Have you ordered them alphabetically? That's frowned upon, I think, in bookcase credibility.
No. Working in a bookshop for many years cured me of that. I keep authors together.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mostly. I don't do anything more formal than that, which means I do spend a lot of time not quite knowing. I mean, every room in the house has got books in it, so I don't quite know where things are half the time. What about you? We never really talked about this. What do you? I've been to your house, John. I know you've got books everywhere and not in any particular order, have you?
No, only because I'm too lazy to do that, and also because I don't know, like you, bookshops. And what I can't ever quite get my head around are the people who colour code their bookshelves.
Like Nicholas Royal, he's mad about it, isn't he? His pictures on Twitter of like one room's all green, one room's all blue.
I mean, I wouldn't judge, but it must make it quite difficult to find things. Even more difficult than my. I always know where books are. That's one thing. But I just sometimes it takes ages because there are too many. I haven't got enough bookshelves.
Do you ever worry that the bookcase will be gazed upon by visitors?
I don't worry about that. I've got one downstairs that I've
less so at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. It's not such a big issue. But I've got one to use the C word. I've got one curated, definitely bookshelf downstairs where I've got, which I call because the boys, for some reason, they stuck a couple of green men figures on there, sort of dad's old country weirdo crap shelf, which is full of books.
That's a name for a TV show, isn't it?
full of books, which I haven't talked about this on the podcast with books like this on it, which I have to say is
Witchcraft, Secret Societies of Rural England, The Magic of Toadmen, Plough Witches, Mummers and Bonesmen.
Bonesmen, yeah. It's brilliant. Yeah, that I've got a lot of that kind of stuff.
And how do our guests deal with their books? Nikita, your so-called child, I see, has a fairly lackadaisical approach to.
That's right. There's nail
shelving.
The child has put nail polish at the front of the books. I put authors together, but they're not alphabetical, and I definitely curate the bookshelves as a kind of pastime. So I will just walk past a bookshelf and take one off that's not really visible and place it in a visible, but I don't really know who's gazing. That's the existential question around the bookshelf. I just keep dragging books out and putting them on show, but I don't know who it's for.
let's return to your childhood. No, is that because you want to, do you like what we would have called in the bookshop a face out? Do you want like a face out to just vary up
possibly
a bit for your day-to-day existence? Or is your brain thinking, wow, it would be amazing if I don't know, Jeanette Winterson called in?
I think it's both things are going on, if I'm The lockdown provokes a kind of honesty. I try to answer the question as honestly as possible now.
Great. Well, that's interesting. I like that.
So I would dream of a high-profile, high-status gazing person to come in. But also I am trying to create an aesthetically pleasing bookshelf day to day. You're right. I hadn't thought about that before. I'm doing both because a lot of the time a high-stakes gazing person doesn't enter the room.
Well, you know what they say, file your books like nobody's watching.
Yeah. we did some bullshit research back in the day at Waterstones about this, and it, unsurprisingly, I think books came up ahead of clothes as the things that people felt most spoke of their true selves, which I've always thought that's one of those things that people obviously say in research things, you know, to try and make themselves look cleverer and more interesting and deeper. You know, like that great quote of Kafka is, you know, a book is an axe that breaks the frozen sea within us. Well, sometimes, Franz. Yeah. I mean, sometimes yeah. It's just a
Merry Christmas.
It's just something entertaining we take on holiday. Surely that's all right. Surely.
And Matt, I notice you are in a room with dead media behind you. Is that dead media?
Yeah, I know. It is dead. Well, it's a mixture. There's some, well, it's various types of different dead media, I guess. So our filing system, our family filing system, which involves everything from, you know, vinyl to CDs to DVDs to books to whatever, 8-track, is that, so Leslie and the children very carefully put everything into alphabetical order when we moved house. As soon as we had one room that was just full of A to D, we realised how much rubbish there was at the beginning of the alphabet. No offence to writers who were at the beginning of the alphabet.
the recklessness of what you just said. Well done.
So we had to mix it up a bit. So yeah, it's a bit like Nikita said. It's kind of a curated thing. But then I say to somebody, oh, well, this room's just the... You know, when one of these high-profile, whatever they are, MVP people that Nikita has come around, I always say to them, well, this is the room where I just put the rubbish, and then realise that their book's on the shelf. So, you know. And that's the other thing, is that if you've got a writer coming around to your house, and I speak, you know, I've experienced this myself, do you want to see your book on their shelves? Or do you... And equally, if they're coming round, are they going to be embarrassed if they suddenly see all of their books piled up, or are they going to be delighted? It depends on the author, right? I mean, so I think John Irving would be
delighted,
very happy if he went into a house and he saw all of his books in a row.
So you're going around to a friend's house, Matt, and you know they've got at least one or more of your books. Do you hope to find it in the living room? Or in the spare room, or
I think next to the bed is toilet. the dream, isn't all it? In that pile that they return
always there. 15 years, it's always been on their bed.
15 years,
Matt.
It's just stayed there. I'll read that book one day.
What about on the landing? I've seen my book on that sort of strange small bookshelf on the landing. Do you know that one in people's houses?
I know exactly. Is that a sort of nice things that the guests might want to read?
Now I understand.
It's sort of that. It's also no man's land as well, isn't it?
This is a book I own, but I don't feel particularly vested in, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, and I don't know where it's supposed to go. You know, it's like it might be a, it might be useful.
Yeah. Has anyone ever found their books in a holiday cottage or an Airbnb?
All the time.
Once. I've seen it once. It was that felt exciting, very exciting.
Did you sign it? I suppose so. You should have signed it, Nikita.
Yeah, I should have.
You should have said, I was here. I stayed here.
Yeah, signed it in a really audacious way. Overly intimate. An overly intimate signing.
Yes, I'll never forget you.
Oh. Let's get on with the show. We got so much chat.
Loads of chat. Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today, you find us in the stolid, mist-damped streets of post-war Vienna, hurrying past half-empty restaurants and pastry shops in search of a lost child, while near us just out of sight, there lurks the sinister, warty-skinned creature known as the Undertoad. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund the books they really want to read.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today for the second time on Backlisted is the double act of Nikita Lalwani and Matt Thorne.
Hello.
Hi, Andy.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, guys. John.
And Nikita and Matt were last here, unbelievably, 2 years ago, to talk about The Terrifying Something Happened by Joseph Heller, which some of us are still recuperating from. Yeah.
It still haunts me, that book. It really does. I think about it. I doubt a week goes by when I don't think about it and the ghastly Bob Slocum.
But we really love that book and we love that episode. And when we all went to the pub after the recording and we knew it was a good one, we had a conversation where we said, well, it would be great to get Matt and Nikita back. But this time, like, because I think Matt chose Something Happened. So it's Nikita's turn to choose something. And Nikita, what did you choose?
The World According to Garp by John Irving.
So we've all been in lockdown reading The World According to Garp. And I can tell you from the conversations that have already taken place off air that everybody has thoughts that they wish to express in the next hour or so. So we'll get to it as quickly as we can. So let me introduce our guest first. Nikita is the author of three novels, including her latest, You People, just out from Viking, and which I talked about on our last episode. For those of you listening to that, if you haven't listened to the last episode, please listen to me talk about how much I loved Nikita's novel on that. The reason I did it last time is because I slightly wanted to spare her blushes this time, but it was such a great book.
Wonderful, wonderful book. I finished it this week as well, Nikita. I'm really, really full of admiration for it.
Well, thanks so much, guys.
No, thank you. Yeah. For making me get out of Kent for a bit. That's what I'd say to anyone now. That's my new way of saying thanks for your book, which is thanks for getting me out of Kent.
Getting me out of Kent.
Anyway, You People has been optioned for television by World Productions, creators of The Bodyguard and Line of Duty. Nikita is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and her work has been translated into 16 languages. And the thing I wanted to ask you, Nikita, is what's it been like publishing a new novel now in the middle of all this?
It's been very different week to week. So obviously the book came out on something like April the 2nd, so lockdown had just begun. And initially there was that palpable loss of not being able to touch the book in a bookshop, which actually is quite important to me. I didn't realise that that was the visual I was getting. No launch and chance to kind of celebrate in person, but that felt like a small thing given what everyone was going through and what we were all going through together. I feel like the book community has really come together in really moving ways to promote books at the moment. So there are all kinds of platforms and initiatives and writers supporting writers. Lots of video sharing and discussions going on. Lots of stuff happening on podcasts and on the whole radio circuit. And reviews have started happening and that's exciting. And now there's a whole conversation about people wanting to read in lockdown. So I feel like the book is very much discussed, even though it's not in a physical bookshop. It feels like it's on a virtual shelf somewhere. And
yeah, on the landing.
It's on the landing. It's on the landing of someone's house in a virtual bookshop.
And most importantly, in what formats can we or listeners buy You People at the moment?
So yeah, it's available in hardback with various booksellers now. So it's in stock and it is turning up after about a week if you buy it online.
Good.
And you can buy it as an ebook too. So You People is also an audiobook as well. So there are three different ways to experience
Amazing.
It. But
All right.
That's also exciting that
Excellent.
It's in stock and booksellers are sending it everywhere. So as I say, the feeling goes up and down because it's not communal in a physical sense, but there is this really cheering communal experience going on in terms of the dialogue around it.
Wow, thank you. That's really upbeat. I turn to Matt now to bring us down. So
yeah. That's what I'm here for.
So Matt is also a novelist with 6 books under his belt, including 8 Minutes Idle, which was adapted into a film by BBC Films. He's also written 3 children's books, and his most recent book was a critical study of the pop star Prince, and that was published by Faber. Matt, I'm going to ask you the question that you shouldn't really ask writers at the moment, but are you getting any writing done?
It's been a weird lockdown for me, as I'm sure it has for everyone else, but initially I was reviewing for the Catholic Herald, and I'd been given a pile of books that were completely appropriate for the lockdown. And the first one was about solitude, and then there was a second one about death, and then the third one was about the afterlife. So it...
That's it. That's the whole of human experience in 3 books there.
Matt Thorne rubbing his hands together in glee.
No, in terror. But it was something to do. And it felt like, you know, and it felt like, because I mean, you know, immediately all the columnists on Twitter have been saying, oh, these novelists will write novels about coronavirus and they'll be terrible. We won't want to read them. And there are even novelists saying things like, what's that guy, Alex Preston? He was saying that that we'll all be writing adultery novels. It will all be about, you know, somebody's gone in the lockdown and they can't get to see their mistress. And nobody's going to write these books. Well, maybe they will, but I feel that when this is over, people won't want to think about it for a while. You know, it's going to take a while. It's going to be, you know, there's going to be a bit of reckoning. So I didn't really, and also there's a lot of people who haven't written before who are suddenly writing now. Like, I'm in a WhatsApp group and everybody's with my neighbours and they're all going, oh, we're all starting our novels now. This is important. Let's remember history. And I think this is the worst time to ever start a novel.
Please don't. You know? Please don't. No.
I mean, not only will you have all the books that were postponed from last year that will come out next year, you'll have all the books that people wrote during this time and all the books by people who are starting afresh.
Yeah.
So I was quite happy to be writing these reviews because it meant I could respond to what was happening and my own feelings, but with the venue of reviewing these books, so it didn't feel completely self-indulgent or separated from what's actually happening. And then, as with a lot of these things, the Catholic Herald has then reduced their numbers of issues, and you know, newspapers and magazines are, you know, going through a difficult time at the moment. So that's gone away. So then, fortunately, I do have a contract for a non-fiction book, so I'm working on that. So I'm quite happily working on non-fiction, and it's a music-related book. But in terms of writing fiction, I think it's impossible. I mean, I'm sure there will be people who write brilliant novels about this time. Of course, I mean, that's always the case. But I do think we have to go through these stages of first understanding what's happened. And then I think the books that will be really interesting won't be the ones that remember this time, but they deal with what happens after this. And I think what I've heard, particularly from TV people at the moment, what they're looking for is really upbeat stuff about things like that. What's he called? Colonel Tom or Major Tom or whatever he's called, Captain Tom. You know,
they're very different Toms. Very different Toms.
But you know, everybody's going to want these really optimistic stuff. But I think it will be. There's also room for a kind of a noir response to it, in that, you know, not dealing with any of the terrible things that happened, but what the world's going to be like after this, when we're all starting to learn how to do things again for the first time in a way. And that world will be really interesting. I think that will make writing about that world will be far more interesting than writing about this.
Also, somebody pointed out there's not a lot of Spanish flu literature.
No, exactly. Yeah.
So it may well be, as you suggest, that this period is not the period people want to write about, and it's what comes next that whatever that's going to be. John, what have you been reading this week?
Well, I've been reading, not in any kind of, for any morbid reason, but a fortnight ago, Tim Robinson died of COVID complications. He was suffering from Parkinson's as well, and he was in his 70s, late 70s. He is an artist and a writer and a map maker. And he moved to the Aran Islands in 1972. He was born in Yorkshire and lived in various places in Europe, and moved with his wife, Merid, to the Aran Islands, where he set about making the most incredibly detailed physical maps of pretty much every stone, every rock on the island, but also gathering stories and researching history and owning that particular tiny little place on the planet in order to tell an amazing epic story of evolution and of kind of philosophical development. And he produced a series of books, but the one I wanted to talk about today is the first one, which is called Stones of Aran Pilgrimage, which is his account of a journey sunwise around the largest of the Aran Islands. This was published in 1986 by a small Irish publisher, Wolfhound Press. And then he was taken up by Lilliput Press, another small Irish publisher, and eventually he was published in Penguin. It won all kinds of awards. He's like the spiritual godfather of the whole of what you might call the sort of Robert McFarlane school of writing. It's a beautiful, rich, I mean, he's better than almost anybody who's ever tried to do it, because he takes one place. You know, I've always said in this, I like the practitioners. I like the people who are shepherds or who make dry stone walls, who live in the landscape because it's their job. Although he was an outsider, nobody has, he learned the language. He totally soaks himself in this tiny little bit of land, and he spins out of it the most amazing stories. It's a beautiful book. He was a remarkable man. He came over to London with his wife, and then he got ill and he couldn't go back, and he died, and his wife died 2 weeks after he died. They had worked together for 50 years on this extraordinary project. It's an amazing story. I'm just going to read you a tiny little bit, because it turns out to have a slightly kind of John Irving-y feeling to it, but it gives you just a feeling for the prose. A last impression, a stumpy-legged dog, white with brown blotches, mainly gun dog, but with a bit of seal in him, according to his owner. Our adopted pet, Oscar, dearly loved and sadly missed, as the death notices put it. I used to throw a ball for him on the strand, a game that almost killed the neglected creature with delight. If I stood forgetful with ball in my hand, lost in my musings over the riddles propounded by the sea to the sand, he would wait patiently at my feet, looking up, and very delicately place a paw on my toe to recall me. Then I would glance down and catch him saying, "There are just two ways, or perhaps three, in which you can hope to give supreme pleasure to another living being. You can go home and make love to her who loves you, or you can throw that ball for your dog. This is the time for the second alternative, for the third is to go on trying to perfect your book, which I do not believe you have it in you to do. No, dogs do not speak. The sea does not riddle. Dolphins do not pray. The vagrant bird neither trusts nor distrusts, Robinson. Waves never sign anything. What I myself witness is my own forgery. One should forego these over-luxuriant metaphors that covertly impute a desire of communication to non-human reality. We ourselves are the only source of meaning, at least on this little beach of the universe. These inscriptions that we insist on finding on every stone, every sand grain, are in our own hand. People who write letters to themselves are generally regarded as pathetic, but such is the human condition. We are writing a work so vast, so multivocal, so driven asunder by its project of becoming coextensive with reality, that when we come across scattered phrases of it, we fail to recognize them as our own." Beautiful.
Yeah, that's quite good.
And quite Irving-like, I thought, that whole so multivocal, this sort of trying to turn the world into something that is intelligible. It's our own handwriting, but we don't recognise it. Andy, what have you been reading?
Well, what I've actually been reading is another novel by Sheena Mackay called Heligoland. But I'm not going to talk about it, partly because I've got something else to talk about, but also because I loved it so much. It's one that I've put on the
you loved it so much you put it in the fire.
I put it on the landing bookshelf.
On the landing,
because I hope we might do a full episode on Sheena Mackay or on that novel. So
I've never read it, and but I love her intensity that is.
But also because we've got Matt here, and because an exciting
Don't blame me for this.
I've been reading Lie Contain Multitudes, and there's another much longer one called Murder Most Foul.
Murder Most Foul.
And Murder Most Foul has one of the historic things about it, apart from the fact it's 17 minutes long, is it Bob Dylan's first number one single in the States?
Yeah, I think that's true, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's the first time he's ever got to number one.
Incredible.
Wow.
Before I turn to Matt, who is a Dylan aficionado, Nikita, are you a Dylan fan?
Yeah, I'm a huge Dylan fan. And when I was listening to that then, I just felt a deep fondness.
I know.
A deep pleasure. It's so mischievous. It's Bob just mashing it all up, shaving off all hierarchies.
Yeah.
I like fast food and I drive fast cars. I mean, it's really audacious.
I picture him doing both those things.
He's daring you. I mean, it's a daring, you know, it's chew on this. You know, I dare you not to smile. I dare you not to laugh at this absurd practice of making art. Something like a little bit reminded me a bit of his Nobel Prize speech, actually.
Yeah.
I tell you what it reminds me of is Sir Mix-a-Lot's Baby's Got Back. You know, it's like, I like big butts and I cannot lie. That's what it says, isn't it? Not great literature.
Also a great song.
I Contain Multitudes is ironically named because it seems to have only one note. The whole melody is one note. But what you hear on that clip is really fascinating. Classic Dylan thing there of, like you were saying, Nikita, from one line to another, you know, that some of them are silly. You know, the use of the phrase, those British bad boys, the Rolling Stones, is the tip, right? But then suddenly it switches into something really Dylan-y and melancholy and timeless.
Moving.
William Blake. Yeah, Matt, what were you saying about these songs?
Well, you know, I understand that some people have made these arguments and a lot of people seem to agree. But for me, it just sounds like he's on the landing of his house looking down the books and just reading them out.
Which was also a criticism made of the Nobel speech, wasn't it?
It's like Charles Dickens. Anyone could do it. Like Charles Dickens, I'm having hard times. You know, like George Eliot, there's no mill on my floss. The other way around, no floss on my mill. You know, I mean, it's easy. You know, you just got to get in the right order. But apart from that, it's, you know, I mean,
this is a lot more knowing. This is like him saying, he was standing in the doorway looking like the Jack of Hearts. I think it's more like that. It's very curated, sculpted, put together. It's not deranged in the way you're suggesting, Matt.
Look, I've got his notes, Matt. I've got his notes here, and he's written, like you were saying, floss mill something something mockingbird kill. He's trying to work towards that.
No, I mean, that's been the thing for years, hasn't it? That he has just borrowed, and people don't mind, but, you know, he has just borrowed from lots of books. There were the Japanese novels where he borrowed all the lines. But I think he's reached the stage now where he really doesn't care. You know, I mean, because Murder Most Foul as well, that's a book about JFK, isn't it? That's where he got the title for the song from, was that there was this book about JFK.
Amongst the Dylanologists, though, that is sort of, you know, he'd always said he would never write about the assassination because it was too important to him, and then he has, and I just, it's fascinating to watch the kind of the cascading discussions online of but what is he really saying? And it's, I mean, I don't know, I love the levity he has in these songs. It's just great.
Do we know if these are new or if they've been sitting around for?
Well, I mean, the story is that they've been sitting around since about 2012. And he did. There's a couple of songs like this, aren't there, on Tempest? There's one about the Titanic and then one about John Lennon. And I think, charitably, I would like to think that he wrote maybe 100 of these in the same style. And he's parceled them out and he's thought, OK, well, you know, let's just put out a couple now.
The landing tapes.
Put out eight more in a few weeks. Exactly. What I don't want is a whole album.
Matt,
of this. It's gonna be terrible.
I want a double album, side one, Murder Most Foul, and three more songs, one per side, and each.
It's a Christmas album. It's what you need to play at Christmas.
Each cover. Maybe there'll be a song about Spanish flu, which will last. Yeah,
I think he's taking John Lennon. He's taking the big iconic subjects. It's great. Yeah, with a sort of, you know, with, as you say, Andy, one maybe two notes. It's great.
Isn't he just acknowledging that all writing is a form of plagiarism when he does this. I do think he does it on purpose. It feels so rhythmically put together. It's not an accident, is it? It's not just all falling into a page of cuttings.
It's the folk tradition.
It
TM.
Is.
It's the folk tradition. That's what he always says, isn't it?
But you know, given that he actually knows the Rolling Stones, couldn't he come up with a better way of describing them than the British Bad Boys?
He's using vernacular. Isn't it? What's wrong with that?
There's a lot of this going on with Bob all the time, isn't there? Everything.
Well, Nicky is saying 5 minutes are up, but Nick, I think this should be 17 minutes long.
We'll pick this up again after some adverts. Stay tuned to this.
Let's turn to the main event, which is The World According to Garp by John Irving, first published in 1978 by Dutton in the US and Gallants in the UK. And I'm going to ask each of us in turn, and I'll start. I last read a book by John Irving in 1990. Mitch, when did you last read a book by John Irving?
I think I can beat that. The last John Irving I read was in 1989, which was A Prayer for Owen Meany.
And did you see him read from it at Waterstones in Charing Cross Road, as our friend Jonathan asked yesterday?
I did. It was one of the great nights, actually. There was it was absolutely one of the best readings I've seen by anybody. And that sequence of readings at that shop, which had started some years earlier with Tobias Wolff, the sort of dirty realism to it, and Richard Ford. But Irving absolutely knocked it out of the park. It was amazing. Doing the very high-pitched capital letter voice kind of Owen Meany. It was brilliant.
And Nikita, when did you last read a book by John Irving, other than this one?
I think I read Owen Meany about 2 years ago. Yeah.
For the first time or rereading it?
For the first time. So I first read John Irving only 6 years ago.
Okay.
So we'll come to that.
We'll. That's fascinating. And Matt, when did you... are you? You're a fan, aren't you? You're an Irving fan.
Yeah, within reason. I mean, I tried to find before I came on here the last one that I reviewed, but because newspaper databases have all disappeared now, I reviewed one for The Independent. And I can't remember, which probably isn't a good sign, whether it was Until I Find You or A Widow for 1 Year. But I did read Last Night at Twisted River, which I think was a couple ago. But I haven't read the last one. The last one didn't appear to be on the radar at all. I don't have any kind of recollection of that even coming out, to be honest. But I was reading him pretty regularly up until there's one where he's just working in a restaurant, and he actually did go and work in a restaurant. And the first 100 pages are about him making an omelette or something, and I just couldn't read anymore. That was where I gave up.
I feel for a lot of people that John Irving sort of... If you're our generation, lots of people read Irving in the 80s or early 90s, and he's carried on, of course, being a tremendously successful author, published 14 novels. He's still widely read, but I think there's a sense that perhaps he slightly belongs to that era when he first rose to prominence. And when you guys suggested we do Irving and do Garp on here, I was thinking, oh, that'd be interesting. It'll be nice to hook up with John Irving again after such a long gap, because I had really enjoyed the books of his that I'd read. And coming back to it, I thought, wow, this is totally fascinating. This is not the book I thought it was going to be, or by the author I thought John Irving was. So there you go. That goes to show what I should have kept paying attention over the last couple of decades. Matt, when did you first read Irving or Garp? Or both?
Well, I mean, when I was a kid, my mother used to go to this place called the Settlement, which was sort of it was a bit like Jenny Fields's you know, kind of encampment in the book. And I remember this book really hit all those people there really hard. This was in the 70s. It was about, I guess it was probably about 79. I would have been about 5 or 6, a little bit older. And everybody, there was a real buzz about this book. And I remember thinking, I really want to read this book, even though from an early, I was too young to do it. And then when I was about 12 or 13, it was in the school library. And I was just drawn, you know, there's that cover that had a kind of fetus on the cover. It looks a bit like a sort of a razorhead fetus. So I had no idea what the book was. It looked like an entire book about a baby. And everybody was getting really upset about it and really passionate. And I just remember these people, somebody said, how dare you read that book? He says such terrible things about women. And then somebody else was saying, you know, but it's such a feminist novel. He's the most important feminist writer there is. And I just, you know, seeing literature cause that kind of fuss made me maybe want to read it as soon as I possibly could.
And Nikita, when did you, so if you started reading Irving about 5 or 6 years ago, when did you get to this one?
So I started with this one. So it was that very exciting thing of reading something in adult life that completely takes you over in the way that you might develop passions for reading a writer. I don't know, the way you might feel that when you're 16 or in the sixth form or at university. Those are very particular sweet fallings, aren't they? Yeah. The ones that you do in the early journeys of literature and literature loving. And also you really hate writers then. And then later, when you're writing, I mean, you love and hate, you know, in that sort of very Irving Garp-esque way. The feelings are very strong. And then when I read this, which was 6 years ago, I was actually teaching creative writing and was already a writer. And so I wasn't expecting anything to really bowl me over in that way. And I saw it on a list of a course that another writer was teaching, James Hawes. And he was a colleague, and I thought, oh, I've never read that. Maybe I'll read that now. Maybe now's the time to finally read it. Of course, the book was very much in public consciousness, I thought, and I knew about it. I knew about the film. I hadn't seen the film either. And so I read it then, and just the bombast of it and the humour and the politics and the unapologetic absurdity and the somersaulting bravura style, I just, you know, laughing and crying as I read it, often in the same page. I thought it was amazing.
Certainly, it is amazing. I don't think anybody who can read it would not be amazed by just the sheer chutzpah of the book. It's unflagging, I think. Incredible.
One of the things that totally surprised me about it is I think I thought it would be like reading a Tom Robbins novel. You know, it would have that slightly 70s-ish kind of vibe, right? It would be a sort of like, or a slightly Dice Man-y kind of feel to it.
A book that would have Zany on the cover.
Yeah, Matt, that is exactly right. Zany. And what really blew me away is how contemporary it felt in terms of some of the issues that it deals with.
Unbelievable, yeah.
And we've got a clip here of John Irving talking in 2018 when the novel was reissued about why it might speak to people now.
I even imagined as I was writing this novel more than 40 years ago now that it would be out of date before I finished it. It seemed to me that the kind of sexual discrimination I was writing about was truly too backward to last. Well, I was wrong. Things may be better, but in many areas of the world, in my birth country, the United States included, women are still treated as if they were sexual minorities. And from the sympathy I've always felt for women being treated as sexual minorities, I recognized that smaller actual sexual minorities, gay men, lesbian women, transgender men and women, were treated even worse. I'm dismayed that sexual intolerance is still tolerated 40 years after I was writing about it. But it is. That's why I say it's not, to me, entirely good news that The World According to Garp is still relevant, and why I say it should be a period piece.
So that's what I mean. I thought we were getting a period piece, and we get this full-on assault on, it seems to me anyway, on
attitudes to gender and sex roles and all those things that you might expect to read in a very contemporary novel now.
Yeah. And I mean, violence all the way through it. It's unbelievable.
Like Matt, you were saying like that people were saying to you when you were a kid, you shouldn't be reading this because of some of the things that he says about women. But other people were saying, well, you shouldn't be reading it because he says the opposite to what the first group of people were saying. You know, when you came back to it now, how did you feel about it reading it as a grown up in 2020?
Well, I think there are two levels that the book is interesting on. You know, one is for writers, you know, because it's so much about writing, even though the Irving says, you know, it's not about writing. That's not the most important thing. That's not true. It is about writing. You know, that's very important. And the other thing is the sexual politics. And the thing is, the books that he'd written up until then do have a very sort of 70s feel about their sexual politics. And it is, you know, it is all that zany thing where everybody's having an orgy every chapter. And, you know, it's all very sort of disturbing. And there's a bit of that in this. But it's so different to the sexual attitudes in a John Updike novel or a, you know, Saul Bellow novel or a Philip Roth novel. You know, he really gets involved with gender politics fearlessly and without sort of steering it towards the male camp as other male writers do. But at the same time, there is a sort of incredible sexual graphicness about it. And he does write so much about rape and abuse and about men doing terrible things to women. But at the same time, you've got a character who's going around sleeping with prostitutes, and that's just part of the parcel, and that's fine, and it's okay. You know, it's a very unusual form of sexual politics. You know, it feels on one hand very enlightened, but on the other, it's written in a time where, you know, I mean, maybe because it's pre-AIDS, maybe because it's pre that kind of morality, it feels very sort of confusing in that way. You know, I mean, and also obviously the autobiographical connections. You know, he went to university in Vienna, so lots of his novels have sections set in Vienna. But the idea of going with your mother to Vienna and your mother buying prostitutes for you. And I mean, when I read, it's a bit like Something Happened, I was saying it was really weird reading it as a child and thinking that's what the adult world is like, you know. So, so when I read that, when I was too young, not to know any better, I was just thinking, oh, well, maybe when I'm 18, I'll go off to Vienna with my mother and, you know, she'll arrange these prostitutes and that will be fine and everybody will think it's lovely.
And was it? I must ask Nikita, what did you make of the sexual politics of it when you read it in the year 2014?
Well, it's interesting because just the fact that Matt read it at 12, John Irving in that foreword that you've just quoted him reading from, to the 40-year anniversary, I think, or one of the anniversaries, he says that he gave it to his son to read when he was 12 and he was worried and nervous about what the son would think. And I'm thinking now, was he worried that we all essentially read fiction thinking that it's a guide or a manual to living? So like Matt wonders when he's reading it at 12 whether he'll go to Vienna and have, you know, sexual favours delivered to him courtesy of his mother's purchasing powers, whether John Irving thinks that's going to happen to his child. It's really interesting when you read it. I think that the sexual politics are very honest and warts and all. And he kind of is so under the skin of feminism of that time and so respectful of it at so many points in the book, and also just really hates it, just really hates the fact that the feminist who feels most kind of endearing to me, which is his mother, who's a very strong Marmite-ish character and annoys a lot of readers, that she can constantly quiz him on male lust and constantly interview him about male lust and constantly ask about it and not know it. And he's just like, enough already with the male lust questions. Yeah. But he also is so sympathetic to feminism and to the trans situation, and he said somewhere that he kept writing the trans character into all his books. Roberta turns up in some form or another in all of his books, and that huge identification, as Matt has said, with women and women's politics, femaleness and the primacy of female needs, urges, discrimination, all of that is done actually very respectfully at many points in the novel, and then it's torn down by Garp in moments of sort of pitiful anger, or He's not very sympathetic when he tears down feminism.
Don't you think it felt to me like a book clearly written? I think what you're both saying is spot on, actually. It's a book written in America in the 70s where many writers are trying to make sense of what's been shaken down by the so-called permissive societies, you know, what's happened in the 60s. And what I think so interesting about reading Irving is he might not get it totally right, but he's a lot more respectful, as you suggest, of lots of aspects of it, or seeking to find balance in a way that I think other more lionized male American writers probably weren't trying to do. You know, they're trying to see exclusively from what does this mean for men. That's not what's going on in this book.
Yeah, he's trying to do it whilst also acknowledging that identity politics are, by their nature, that sort of 70s essentialism is infuriating. So to be reduced to just one of many plural identities is infuriating. So he is trying, as you say.
Infuriating, that's right. That's right. That's one of the key notes, isn't it? It's the book is infuriated as a series of things pass before the narrator's eye, which infuriate him.
And Garp is himself infuriating, and Garp, without giving everything away, but he pays for that ultimately by being a kind of a gadfly. It's a brilliant book. I have to say about family life as well. It's a brilliant book about parenting, about the dread, the constant existential dread that all parents have. Of wanting to try and control their children and trying to steer them away from danger, but at the same time, knowing that in some part that you have to expose them for danger for them to grow. He did say, didn't he? He said that he alternated all the time between which character he liked the best in the novel and what the book. For a long time, Jenny Field, Garp's mother, was a more important character to him than Garp, and she is a kind of magnificent character in lots of ways. But as you say, Nikita. Definitely Marmite, you know, definitely. There's nobody in this book you can confidently say that's the calm, steady, moral core of the book. They're all fucked up in different ways.
Well, I think he's a very messy writer, isn't he? I mean, that's one of the... I mean, the people who don't like him, they don't like his prose, and they don't like the way that he writes and structures things. And I think some of that mess is left in the book. You know, he talks, again, in that introduction Nikita mentioned, he talks about how he originally started it in 1786, and then he started it with Jenny, and then he started it with Garp, and, you know, that's still there. You can see that these are all sort of broken pieces that aren't completely put back together. You know, it's not... I mean, I think that those are the two problems that people have with him, are the quality of the prose and that kind of insistence on a Dickensian structure without really the underpinnings to do it. But he somehow manages to get through all of that and produce stuff that's so good, sort of chapter by chapter and incident by incident, that you don't care. You know, the quality of the prose is almost irrelevant.
I want to talk later on about that Dickensian thing, about how he uses plots, not what the plots are in his books, but how he uses plot. I think that's one of the things that really distinguishes Irving as a writer. It's that it's almost the sense you were talking about things being in quotation marks. Plot in Irving's books is often in quotation marks. A thing needs to happen now, reader. Yeah. And so I'm going to put
boy,
a thing before
boy,
you.
Does it? Always.
It's also about whether he'll pull it off, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
The plot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that whole thing of putting massive chunks of novels in your
so
book
brave.
And short stories. It's like, I mean, no, I don't, you know, hardly anyone has ever done that because, you know, unless it's things like, you know, back in the classic era, like maybe, you know, Decameron or Don Quixote. But, you know, to just have so much of a different novel in your book. I mean, if you took those bits out, the book would collapse. It only really works in a way. And that's where the film had some problems, because it's a method of delivering all these other stories at the same time.
I'm going to read the blurb, as we do traditionally on That Listed. And what I've got is the flap copy from the US first edition. So before this book was a bestseller, and this was John Irving's first bestseller, before John Irving had a great reputation and this book's arrived, you know, we're sort of familiar with what Irving represents, but readers, publishers...
Yeah.
42 years ago, I was reading it, I was thinking, how did they market this book, right? So here's what they here's what was on the jacket of the US first edition. And this will set it up for listeners who haven't read it as well. Like the great novels of the past that moved us profoundly and still echo in our minds. Now that's starting high. The world, according to Garp, creates a populous world and persuades us to dwell in it for an extended time. Garp's world is an imagined one, but it lights up the real world for us with all its terrors and delights, its themes of rage and love, its alternation between comedy and tragedy. New para. The main story in the world, according to Garp, brackets, and it is a novel filled with stories, close brackets, is of a, that's a publisher's touch, well done, is of a man with a famous mother, a man who reaches toward fame himself. Jenny Fields is the black sheep daughter of an aristocratic New England family. She becomes, almost by accident, a feminist leader ahead of her time. Her son, T.S. Garp, named for a father he never saw, has high ambitions for his artistic career, but he has an even higher obsessive devotion to his wife and children. Surrounding Garp and Jenny are a wide assortment of people, school teachers and whores, wrestlers and radicals, editors and something I can't read, editors and writers, transsexuals and rapists, and husbands and wives. It is John Irving's special gift that all his characters, even the least lovable among them, are portrayed not just vividly, but affectionately. The pace and language of this novel are edited to Garp's life and career, explosive with energy, full of ribaldry, and a sense of drama. In three previous novels, John Irving established himself as one of the most imaginative writers of his generation. With his new novel, he has taken a quantum leap forward. The world, according to Garp, is a work of extraordinary narrative power, rich, humorous, and wise. I mean, I'd like to think John Irving wrote that.
What's interesting is that there's a lot of positive visualization going on in Garp, because Garp writes a bestseller, doesn't he? Which is virtually called The World According to Garp. It's called The World According to Something Else. But
so weird.
He writes a bestseller and then this becomes a bestseller. I kind of like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the same thing Nabokov used to do, where he puts his novels in, sort of fictionalized versions of his novels. But the thing is, you think that maybe this is the first time he's writing about being a writer, you know, because you might think, well, okay, he'd reached that kind of point in his career where he wanted a bestseller, so he wrote about a best-selling novelist. But his other earlier books are about novelists as well, you know, so he was always writing about himself right from the very beginning. And I think a lot of people don't like books about writers. I love books about writers, but I think writers often do.
Yeah.
But I think there are two ways that he makes it acceptable in this. One is that he writes in the third person, so you don't have the sense of connecting Garp and John Irving too closely. No. And later on, he rewrote another book into the third person because he worked for that very same reason. And the other thing is that he surrounds himself with normal people who come up, well, when I say normal people, you know, policemen and regular everyday characters who come up to him and have an argument with him and say, you know, why should anyone be interested in what your nonsense is? So we have a sense of the real world being around him. And I think that's probably what made it, one of the things that made it a bestseller, is he makes the writer seem like a desirable job, but then puts it in a world of other jobs that are equally desirable and doesn't make the writer this incredible hero figure. He makes him a kind of tragic, doomed person rather than, you know, what would happen in other, when, you know, when Roth, for example, writes about writers and he always wins the argument and he's always the best character and everyone else has to bow down to him. With this, he makes Garp the butt of lots of what's
happening. That's it. Yeah.
Hey, Nikita, I found a list on the internet of things one can expect to find in John Irving novels. And so I'm going to read this out to you and I want you to choose your favourite, right?
Brilliant.
So which of these is the thing you most look forward to finding in a John Irving novel? Is it bears, New England, hotels, Vienna, wrestling, sex, violence, or writing fiction?
Ooh, so it's, I mean, it's definitely not bears, Vienna, or the other one early on.
New England.
It's New England, right? I'm not looking for New England in a John Irving novel. It's probably sex.
Yeah.
Because sex delineates character in this incredible way and is also part of plot. All of the tension is usually concentrated in what happens during sex and also the recompense for the sexual act, isn't it? People are punished or rewarded for their sexual misdemeanors, and that is very interesting. And there's a lot of humor around it, probably sex.
Crime and punishment, that's a big thing for Irving, right? There's the death wish. There's the death wish is a thing in this book which seemed, you know...
I was rereading it, I was thinking about the death wish and I was thinking, I'm not so sure it's... I think, isn't it just straight up fear of death? So he puts it in to tackle the greatest fear. Part of the plot is linked to trying to believe that you could live on after that greatest fear.
But also he does that thing of some characters he kills for drama.
Yeah.
Some characters he kills for thematic necessity. And those that he hasn't killed for drama or thematic necessity, he does a roundup at the end of the book to give you all their deaths.
He feels the book hasn't ended unless it's not. He can't write the end and underline it in with bold unless he's killed everyone.
I mean,
right? I mean, plot spoiler, but yeah.
Sometimes he jumps forward as well, though, doesn't he? That's what I find very unusual. I mean, some other people have done it, I think probably influenced by him as well, where, you know, he'll describe a character in the middle and then he'll say, and that character died in this way 10 years later or 20 years later. So he does weird things with time. You know, he's constantly moved. He's always looking, like every time he meets somebody, he looks at the whole of their life, even if they're just a sort of small character. You know, you'll have a character who crops up.
He does. He loves tying up
yeah.
loves tying up loose ends, doesn't he? He's got that kind of Dickensian thing, definitely, of wanting to make sure that you know right to the very last pages of the book, that you know where everybody's ended up.
So Garp was Irving's fourth novel, and here he is in 2018 again, talking about what the publication of the novel meant for him.
It was my fourth novel. I had learned something from the experience of writing the first three, but it was my first novel with a social subject, my first political novel, my first protest novel, as I would describe it.
Yeah.
And it was written at a time, personally, of considerable duress. I was a full-time wrestling coach, a full-time English teacher, and I had two young children. And I was lucky if I got to write for as many as 2 hours a day and not every day of the week. So whatever I think of Garp with hindsight, I'm eternally grateful to it because it is the book that made me a full-time writer. It is the book that eventually enabled me to write 7 hours a day, 8 days a week. It freed me from having to have other jobs. And I never imagined at the time I was writing it that I would ever be self-supporting as a writer. I had no reason to think I would be.
Nikita, could you read us a little bit of this implausible bestseller?
Well, the bit I was going to read is actually all about this idea that Matt was referencing earlier, where the act of writing is torn down several times and the writer is put in his place or in her place regularly in the book. So it's about halfway in, and it's when Garp gets some hate mail of his own for his second book.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, good.
Which is called...
It was a lively letter by someone who took offence at Second Wind of the Cuckold.
It was
wonderful book title. It was not a blind, stuttering, spastic farter, as you might imagine, either. It was just what Garp needed to lift himself out of his slump. Dear shithead, I have read your novel. You seem to find other people's problems very funny. I have seen your picture with your fat head of hair. I suppose you can laugh at bald persons. And in your cruel book, you can laugh at people who can't have orgasms and people who aren't blessed with happy marriages and people whose wives and husbands are unfaithful to each other. You ought to know that persons who have these problems do not think everything is so funny. Look at the world, shithead. It is a bed of pain, people suffering, and nobody believing in God or bringing up their children right. You shithead, you don't have any problems, so you can make fun of people who do. Yours sincerely, Mrs. I.B. Poole, Findlay, Ohio. That letter stung Garp like a slap. Rarely had he felt so importantly misunderstood. Why did people insist that if you were comic, you couldn't also be serious? And it goes on to talk about how he thinks that people mistake being profound for being sober. But very amusing section.
And he engages, doesn't he? There's so much, again, the resonances with today with kind of social media and trolling and, you know, not getting yourself locked into. There's so much of this book that mm-hmm. feels, as you said right at the beginning, Andy, incredibly contemporary.
When you were reading it, Nikita, I was really pleasantly surprised at how funny the book is on the on the atomic level, that he's got such a good ear for. It's quite muscular, the prose. Matt was saying about the question marks around the prose, but he has got a really good rhythmic ear for landing a gag and landing a one-liner.
And just the fact that that's Mrs. I.B. Poole and she calls him shithead again and again.
Yeah.
But you know that he had that letter, right? I mean, I don't know if he did, but it just feels as if he must have had a letter like that. You know,
absolutely, yeah.
Just like, you know, he got his names from telephone directories. Yeah.
This is Irving talking about being a funny writer.
I think I learned this best from the persona of my old mentor and first reader of my first novel, Kurt Vonnegut, who was one of the funniest writers alive and one of the most depressed men I ever knew. And terrible things happened in his novels too. Mm. But if you have an instinct for comedy, you can't control it. If you are a comic writer, you will be comic, even and perhaps especially at the most awful times. In literature, I've always felt that the better time the reader, the audience, is having right up until the car hits the wall, the more emotionally unprepared they are for the car hitting the wall. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of telling a story in a way that makes my audience feel, oh, this is fun. This is until it isn't.
So, Matt, that speaks to what we were talking about Irving's humour and also what he does with plot. How do you feel that he uses plot in Garp and in some of the other novels?
Well, it's interesting. I was watching the film with my son the other day to prepare for this, and I've watched it before, but I wanted to watch it again, and he was saying that he felt like the entire film was about a side character that you'd have in a compared to the films he watches. He just felt like, why is it all about this man? I mean, it's a very low key performance from Robin Williams, and it's very good. But I kind of feel that up until this point, well, I don't think you can sort of generalize about plots across his books, because I think the earlier books are plotted in a fairly conventional way. Then this one isn't, because he has this weird breakthrough where he starts to put in other books and other stories, and if you took all of that out, it would sort of fall apart. You know, it's really just a sort of, I mean, I think his structure overall is lives, you know, the whole of people's lives, like we were saying. But then I think as he goes on after this, and I'm slightly less keen on the books after that, because I think he became too obsessed with the idea of being Dickensian. Yeah. I think probably a lot of people said, oh, you're like Dickens. And then he started wanting to be like Dickens and then started putting in much more convoluted plots. I mean, he has, like, later on there are murders and crimes, and there's much more of a sense that he's working very hard to plot it. I mean, what I like about GARP is it's almost sort of plotless, but it's full of incident. You know, there's no real, there's the pattern of it, you know, that people come in on page one and they do something terrible at the end. And, you know, but there's no real sense. And there is, as you said earlier, about people being punished for sexuality or bad behaviour, things like that. But there's not really much.
No, he likes, he likes making stuff up. You know, it's sort of, you can feel that. He's really just enjoying. I can do this. Let me see what happens if I drop this in. You feel that the book is kind of, I mean, it's not exactly sprawling, but it's never stable. It doesn't. You don't feel that you're in the hands of somebody who's calmly narrating you through. There are times when you feel it has the potential. It might just all fall apart.
I've got a quote here from his Paris Review interview, where I think every single part of this, I would ask you as I read it, it's very short, to think that what he means is the opposite of what he's saying. John Irving. I'm not a 20th century novelist, I'm not modern, and certainly not postmodern. I follow the form of the 19th century novel. That was the century that produced the models of the form. I'm old-fashioned, a storyteller. I'm not an analyst, and I'm not an intellectual.
Yeah, I mean, that's not true, is it? I mean, and that's just a lie.
Yeah, I don't think any of those things are true, right?
But also, he realises that in the book, because he's got Helen, who, you know, Garp's wife, who's an academic, and is constantly giving lectures on narration or narrative or all that, you know, and he's throwing that in, you know, to almost as a way of saying, look, I know all this stuff, but I'm not going to do it. But I don't get the impression that he does.
And slips a bit of Wallace Stevens in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, and the books that Garp, even the plotting of the books that Garp writes, they sound like crazy books. I mean, like they have some relation to his previous books, but they're much madder versions. I mean, these books couldn't exist in our world. Nobody would read Second Wind of the Cuckold or the mad one. You know, can I read a bit? Is that okay?
Yeah, please. Go.
What I wanted to read is John Wolfe, who's his editor. His response to receiving one of Garp's books, this crazy book. So he's written this crazy book full of rape and violence. And John Wolfe, who's seems like a very decent man. He's one of the characters that I like the most. I wish there were more of his kind in the real world. But decent and stable, exactly. So this is how he responds to receiving this nutty book. And also my wife, who's an agent, when she was watching the film, and it's constantly Garp walking into a publisher's office and saying, "Just publish my book exactly as I wrote it." Keep saying that's not how publishing works, but clearly in Garpland, this is how publishing works. So this is John Wolfe's response to Garp's crazy novel. "What do you mean this is chapter one?" Garp's editor John Wolfe wrote him. "How can there be any more of this? This is entirely too much as it stands. How could you possibly go on?" It goes on, Garp wrote back. "You'll see. I don't want to see it," John Wolfe told Garp on the phone. "Please drop it. At least put it aside. Why don't you take a trip? It would be good for you and for Helen, I'm sure. And Duncan can travel now, can't he?" But Garp not only insisted that this was going to be a novel, he insisted that John Wolfe try and sell the first chapter to a magazine. Garp had never had an agent. John Wolfe was the first man to deal with Garp's writing, and he managed everything for him, just as he managed everything for Jenny Fields.
That's good. I mean, you know, the thing about Garp, you were saying, Nikita, about, life imitating art. I mean, this was a massive bestseller. I mean, 3 million copies sold and, you know, sat on the top of the bestseller lists and was shortlisted for the National Book Award and was in the running for the Pulitzer, was pipped to the post by Cheever. I mean, it not only gave him, as he rather modestly said, financial security, it made him incredibly wealthy, wealthy enough to, you know, buy a place in the Hamptons and couldn't find a house he liked, so he moved a house from New Hampshire, you know, and rebuilt it on the Hamptons. I mean, it's the sort of literary fame. And I'm sure some of the problems that people have with Irving is because he was so successful. I mean, he's kind of almost like the sort of the archetype of the you know, great white American male novelist of the late 20th century.
I've always found it strange that a book like this could be a bestseller, though. Don't you think?
I know. It's such a
strange book. If you're going to break out from an elite literary, all of the things he just said in his quote, where he says, "I am not postmodern, I am not the following, I'm not experimental." It's like the opposite of the Bob Dylan song where he says, "I am X, Y, and Z. He's saying I'm not, but he is. He's sort of, it's like a postmodern joke in saying I'm not. How can that be a bestseller? Somehow, it doesn't feel like a bestseller. It's very hard to summarise it. Even the blurb was failing at summarising it, really.
So when you
it?
Read John Irving now here in 2020, which writers does he remind you of?
Murakami. I mean, I think they're friends and they sort of exercise together. And I think they do. I think they go running. Murakami has translated Irving, and I think he fed into his early style. But I think the indulgences and problems with later Murakami are there in Irving as well. They've almost had exactly, and they've had exactly the same careers. You know, that sort of, you know, with Murakami writing Norwegian Wood and that selling 2 million copies. You know, it's exactly the same career of like 4 or 5 early books, then a big breakthrough, than these wayward later ones.
And constant sort of anxiety about their status in the literary canon.
Yeah.
As a sort of an American original, he reminds me of Randy Newman. He has this ability to create character and to make... You know that thing that Randy Newman does, that his songs are popular with the people he's satirizing. I can sort of see that with Irving, because he takes, particularly in Garb, so many risks. He's on both sides of, as we say, loved by feminists, despised by feminists. And I just think I don't think he's 19th century at all. I think that was brilliant that you're reading that passage out. I think he is really.
Nonsense.
I mean, this is a modernist, a strange kind of, it's totally sui generis in some ways, even within his other books. I mean, I haven't read as many as Matt, but I think Garp is something apart.
I tell you who he reminds me of. I mean, obviously, coming to him now, and we heard that clip of him talking about Vonnegut, I can see a lot of Vonnegut in this book particularly. I don't know about other ones, but in Garp particularly.
Yeah.
The writer that he reminds me of, John, who we did on Backlisted last year, stylistically doesn't really remind me of, but in terms of... Because I listened to lots of Irving interviews when I was preparing for the show, and... The figure he reminds me of is Ray Bradbury, in as much as
that makes sense.
They both have a strong sense of, as writers and as American writers and as American writers in the media, they have a strong sense of their public persona and their figure. Right, that kind of American philosopher salesman. That's what Bradbury was, and that really feels to me like what before we came there, I was saying, and we got so many clips of Irving because he's so good at curating his own persona. So when you listen
brand,
to that,
always be closing.
That's why he shuts down all those characters at the end of the book. You know, I'm hitching up the wagon to the back of the horse and getting out of here.
I think that, that's why it's so satisfying as a book, Garp, that he does finish it, and so many literary novels just build up setting, psychology, character, and then fall off a cliff the minute something interesting happens.
But he's quite nice about writers and writing, isn't he? Because that Alice character who doesn't finish a novel, she's still treated quite respectfully. Every writer, and it's not, I mean, that's one of the things, Nikita, when you were saying about reading it as a writer, I mean, it's quite nice because it doesn't make, even, you know, you don't feel like Irving where he sold 2 million copies. You know, Garp publishes 3 books and two of them are complete failure. His agent's constantly saying to him, you're just a literary writer, you're never going to sell any copies.
Yeah. And there's all that jealousy of his mother that's just nakedly displayed in a really unappealing, unattractive way for Garp.
I just wanted to do that. Look, there's a little bit where I think this whole thing about the popular and the literary, where, as often with Irving, I think he gets a minor character to kind of to carry that sort of debate forward. And there's this brilliant character who is the cleaner for the publisher in the book, Gilsey Sloper. And he's asked her, she occasionally, only twice has she ever wanted to keep a copy of the book. The first was with Jenny's book, the Garp's mum's book, and the feminist book. And the second was this mad novel that John Wolf, the publisher, had sold. He got serialized in Crotch Shots, a porn mag, because he despised it so much. But she likes it, and he says, "Why do you like it?" She says, "Well, I like it because I read it because I want to know what happened." And then she asks, rather kind of shyly, asks him for a copy and says, "Why?" She said, "Well, you know, I thought you were sort. Now you know what happens in it. Why would you want to read it again?" And she said, "I don't know. I might need to lend it to someone." She says, and so he says, "Well, would you ever read it again yourself?" John Wolfe asked. "Well," Chilsey said, "not all of it, I imagine, at least not all once or not right away." Again, she looked confused. "Well," she said sheepishly, "I guess I mean there's parts of it I wouldn't mind reading again." "Why?" John Wolfe asked. "Lord," Chilsey said tiredly, as if she were making finally impatient with him. "It feels so true," she crooned, making the word true cry like a loon over a lake at night. "It feels so true," John repeated. "Lord, don't you know it is?" Jilly asked him. "You don't know when a book's true," Jilly sang to him. "We really ought to trade jobs." She laughed now, the stout three-pronged plug of the vacuum cleaner cord clutched like a gun in her fist. "I do wonder, Mr. Wolf," she said sweetly, "if you know when a bathroom was clean," she went over and peered in her wastebasket, "or when a wastebasket was empty," she said. "A book feels true when it feels true," she said to him impatiently. "A book's true when you can say, yeah, that's just how damn people behave all the time. Then you know it's true."
No, that's my favourite scene in that novel, I must say. So listen, we have to wrap up.
We have to wind up.
So before we go, I'm going to ask each of you in turn. Nikita, I'll start with you. So listeners who haven't read John Irving, maybe they've read him before, they've read Garp, they've come back to Garp. Which John Irving novel should they read next?
I probably A Prayer for Owen Meany, I'd say. That would be a good one to go to next. A good compare and contrast if you're going to go deep.
Well, that's the last one. That's not the last one I read. That's the first one I read when it came out. And I can still remember whole chunks of that book remarkably clearly, which obviously I can't for lots of things I read 30 years ago. So, yes, Matt, a more recent one maybe?
Yeah, maybe Until I Find You. I think the Dickens influence hit hard with Sidehouse Rules and the next few. And then I think he gets back to his weirdness and oddity and all the strangeness in that Until I Find You book. It's too long and it's too rambling and it makes Garp seem completely sensible. I mean, the fact that, you know, Garp really only covers his life to about, you know, mid-30s. In this book, it goes right through. So it's twice the length because his life's twice as long. But I think if you liked Garp and wanted more of the same, I think Until I Find You would be the one that I'd recommend following it up with.
I'd just like to add that it was only when I was reading The World According to Garp that it occurred to me that, because Irving, there have been several films of Irving's work. He wrote the screenplay for Cider House Rules. There's the film of Garp. Matt, you were recommending Door in the Floor, which is an adaptation of Widow for 1 Year. And it was only when I was thinking about those things and thinking, oh, wait a minute, now what is this book reminding me of? Oh, yeah, it's reminding me of Forrest Gump, except Forrest Gump is rubbish. You know, Forrest Gump is like, this explains what Forrest Gump is. It's a rubbish John Irving film that's not written by John Irving,
reminded
right?
of the ambition behind Forrest Gump.
Yeah, right. The idea of a titular character who has a thing wrong with them, who opens up a vista of American history, except, and this is a tribute to John Irving, it's no good, and it's also really conservative. And whatever, you know, reservations we might have expressed about Irving, he's a fair writer, Nikita. This goes back to what you were saying at the beginning. He is prepared to see things from all sorts of points of view, even things that you, the reader, might not immediately identify with.
I do think that that's down to his honesty. It's as though he's made a pact with himself to be honest and not to lie. And therefore, there's an ugliness that has to come out, but there's also a deep river of respect that comes out. So he's always trying to be honest or even-handed, even in each situation, even though, as has been said, he does get it wrong sometimes and he can be really sort of not politically correct. But then, you know, when did you ever read a book that was good, that was deeply politically correct all the way through?
John, let's wind up.
That is a brilliant, brilliant place to end. That's it. thank you to Nikita and Matt for taking us back to that strange and violent but weirdly familiar land of America in the 70s. To Nikki Birch for juggling distant voices and weaving them together with the skill of a great American novelist. And to Unbound for once more furnishing our virtual kitchen table.
You can download all 110 episodes of this, plus follow links, clips and suggestions for further reading by visiting our website at backlisted.fm. And contact us on Twitter or on Facebook.
And you can also now show your love more directly by supporting our Patreon at www.patreon.com/backlisted. We have done this really to keep Backlisted going. We love doing the shows. We want to keep the quality high. We don't want to have to depend on intrusive paid-for adverts where I talk at length about trousers. And I'm sorry to those of you who enjoyed the trouser adverts.
But they are over. They're gone, man. Let those go.
Honestly, just a small gesture of financial support will help us do that. All patrons get to hear Backlisted episodes early, and for the price of two fancy coffees, the lot listener level gets you two whole extra podcasts a month where we... Andy, Nikki and I go off-piste and we talk about music, film, television and art as well as books.
I mean, what I'd like to do is keep Matt and Nikita hostage and we'll record a three-hour Bob Dylan podcast. But sadly, that's
maybe we should. Yes.
Well, if there was ever the time for it, it's now, right?
Anyway, listen, we've been amazed by the support so far. So as promised, here are a few names, the first few names of our recklessly generous Master Storyteller supporters. They get the lot and our undying gratitude, neither cheap nor easy to come by.
It's the Honourable Guild of Master Storytellers, and we have Ian Walker, Clara Abrahams, Grant Samphier, Melissa Gray, Chris Jones, Stuart Hewer, Jen Shenton, and John Dennis. Thank you.
And then we've got, do I add some lock listeners from the roll call of honour here?
I think you could definitely do that, Andy. Yeah. Should we sing them in a kind of
no,
Dylan way?
Let's not. In a Dylan way?
Yeah. Please do.
Thank you.
There was Gordon Baird. He gave us some money. There was Brian Kirkland. He was pretty funny. Too.
Claire Jost, Stephen Musgrave, thank you. Eleanor Robson, Gary Keane, Jackie Patience, thank you very much. Alex Tobin, Martiella, Roseanne Spencer, Jan Postma, Ben Meadows. Thank you all.
Martin Sellers, Cliff Morris, Catherine Wright, Alison Palmer, Jonathan Wilson, Simon Harper, Josh, Louise Strecker.
And finally, we'd like to thank Lorraine Rogerson and Alex Preston, as mentioned by Matt Thorne earlier on this
Indeed.
Podcast.
A former...
Thanks, Alex. Thanks very much.
I didn't think you listened to it. he's a very nice man.
We'll be back. Keep listening. We'll be back in a fortnight, or indeed sooner if you sign up. Yay!
You can choose to listen to Backlisted with or without adverts. If you prefer to listen to it without adverts, you can join us on our Patreon at patreon.com/backlisted, where you also get bonus content of two episodes of Locklisted, the podcast where we talk about the books and films and music that we've been listening to over the last couple of weeks.